I think this year we have the exceptional circumstance of everyone agreeing that today is Eid al-Fitr. So that my rationale that some people will be here at least today and celebrating Eid al-Fitr tomorrow turned out not to be true. Another development is that, as you may tell from my mode of speech, I got sick over the weekend. I have a cold, and I was not therefore able to prepare, as I would have liked to, the lecture on Palestine, which is, I'm sure we will all agree, is an important one, Palestine and the Islamic dimensions of the Palestine question. And moreover, we lack maybe two-thirds of our usual attendance. So what I propose to do today is something lesser. First, a few sort of footnotes and addenda to previous lectures. And then I will solicit from you any questions, observations you may have, particularly with respect to the paper topics that you are contemplating, hopefully you're contemplating. To begin with, one supplementary remark that imposes itself is with respect to this shadowy group that has recently surfaced in Turkey with respect to these two double bombings. You may recall that in my closing remarks on Turkey, I suggested that the parliamentary mode of activity for bringing about some degree of Islamization in society has really reached a dead end. That the main parliamentary party, which is always described as having Islamist roots, has in fact travelled very far from those origins, so that particularly in the sphere of foreign policy, the present government is virtually indistinguishable from its predecessors, believing in the necessity or the beneficial nature of close ties with the United States and also with Israel. And on the other hand, what one might call the revolutionary aspiration, which had arisen in the 1980s, largely as a result of the revolution in neighboring Iran, this too has declined for a variety of reasons. Disappointment, whether justified or not, with events in Iran, developments in Iran, fundamental misunderstandings from the very outset concerning the nature of the revolution in Iran, residual sectarian prejudices arising from centuries of warfare between the Ottomans and the Safavids, and the fundamentally different structure of society and religious authority in Turkey. All of that really tended to make the Iranian model, or what was perceived of as the Iranian model, irrelevant. And in its absence, no new clear alternative came forward, either within the existing system or outside of it. And of course, one exception to that is the group that has claimed responsibility for, is being described as responsible for, the two sets of bombings in Istanbul, first the two synagogues on November the 15th, and then the British consulate and the British Home Bank 5 days later. This organization has a pretty long title in Turkish, which I'm writing out here not to show off my knowledge of Turkish, because it does actually have some relevance once we analyze it. İslami Büyük Doğu Akıncılar Cephesi. İslami, no need to comment on. Büyük Doğu literally means the Great Orient. This phrase goes back to a poet whom I have already mentioned, Necip Fazıl. Necip Fazıl, who started out as a super westernizer, infatuated in particular with French culture, But then, under the influence of a Sufi sheikh, Naqshbandi sheikh, reoriented himself in terms of both ideology and literary production. Najib Farzan published for many years a magazine called Greek or Great Orient. His understanding of Great Orient was a sentimental and nostalgic one. That is, the revival of the Ottoman state, both in terms of its territorial holdings and even in terms of the ruling family. And he was very insistent on this point. To such an extent that he deplored as useless any effort made at restoring Islamic power in any other part of the Muslim world. He told me once that if you lose a watch, where do you look for it? In the place where you lost it. There's no point in going next door to try and find the watch there. Not a very convincing analogy, but what he meant by it was that the caliphate, the Islamic state, could be restored only in that place where it had been lost, namely in Turkey. So the loyalty of this group of bombers to Najib Fazl's idea, a totally anachronistic and sentimental idea, is apparent from the use of this term, Büyükdoğu. As for Akıncılar, Akıncı, one might translate as vanguard. When the Ottomans were engaged in the conquest of the Balkans, the kind of the forward shock troops that they sent had the designation of Akıncı, large in the plural. So in the use of this term also, an anachronism, a deliberate allusion to the Ottoman past, the vanguard. They see themselves as the vanguard, although now they do this by apparently blowing themselves up in cars in Istanbul rather than racing through the Balkans. Cephesi, front. From the very designation of this organization, certain things can be deduced. They regard themselves as the vanguard of a movement which supposedly will restore the Ottoman Caliphate. And they have as their goal a reversal of absolutely everything that has happened since the abolition of the Ottoman Caliphate in 1925, including dress. Some of them have been arrested on occasions before the recent bombings, and they would appear in court in turbans and long cloaks and with beards of the recommended length. They represent, however, an extremely small minority, unrealistic in their goals and irrational in their mode of operation, as we have recently seen. So it is reasonable, I think, to say that the overall assessment that I put forward with respect to Turkey, Yani, remains true. That the parliamentary path essentially has turned out to be a dead end. And on the other hand, the aspiration towards a more comprehensive change outside the system has also met a dead end. And these people have neither a mass following nor any clear chance of success. So that is a supplementary remark concerning Turkey. Then a supplementary remark or two concerning Lebanon, which was, or more precisely, Hezbollah, which was the subject of last time's lecture. I laid stress on the role of Hezbollah in bringing to an end the Israeli occupation of the zone in the south, what was called by the Israelis their security zone. But of course, this is only one aspect of the matter. Since their first foundation, Hezbollah have in Lebanon also exercised a social and economic role. Part of the impetus for the first emergence of Shi'i organizations in Lebanon, first Amal and then Hezbollah, was precisely economic deprivation and misery in the south, and for that matter also in the Shi'i inhabited suburbs of Beirut, where many people took refuge after the Israeli occupation of the south. And accordingly, Hezbollah has always had an important socio-economic dimension. It has run schools, clinics, provided relief, financial aid to the families, particularly of those whose breadwinners have been martyred in the struggle against the Israeli occupation. And in this respect, we may say that Hezbollah is similar both to the Ikhwan in Egypt, the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, as we saw before they were a political party. They were also a socio-economic organization. And indeed, this was really more important than their occasional intervention into electoral politics. And also, they have an important similarity, and they have served as a source of inspiration to the Islamic movements in Palestine, Hamas, and to a lesser extent, Jihad Islami. Hamas, in particular, has had an important role in the provision of relief to the Palestinian population. So that even though the Israeli occupation of the south has come to an end, the role of Hezbollah in Lebanese politics is by no means at an end. They have become a permanent part of the political scene. They also have a TV station, Al Manar, which I don't think you can get on satellite. I'm not sure. However, you can get it on the internet. You can get it on the internet. The website is www.muqawama.org. If any of you are interested in calling it up, it has a news summary in English and Arabic, as well as what do you call it? I don't know the terminology. Anyhow, you can watch Al Manar on the internet, let's put it that way. And it serves as a useful outlet available on the internet for up-to-date information concerning the situation in Palestine. Now that you can no longer get to www.hamas.org, this has been closed down, or not closed down, but anyhow, service is denied, shall we say. This is a good source for up-to-date information. One other point with respect to Hezbollah that is important to note, it is frequently described in the American press simply as an arm of Iranian foreign policy. There was, for example, an article in yesterday's New York Times about a Hezbollah presence in Iraq. And there, Hezbollah was described as Iranian controlled. This is definitely not the case. It will be a mistake to regard Hezbollah as simply an arm of Iranian foreign policy. Without doubt, Iran, in terms of financial and military support, particularly in the early years, was of great importance for the emergence of Hezbollah. Particularly the bombing of the Marine barracks under the circumstances and for the reasons that I described, one can definitely describe as in part, in terms of personnel also, as well as implementation and organization, in part an Iranian enterprise. I could even mention the name of an Iranian Berkeley graduate who was involved in this, however I won't. But despite this, Hezbollah has operational autonomy from Iran. It does not, as it were, take its orders from Iran, nor does it depend entirely upon Iran for its resources. However, there is one interesting point that can be made with respect to Hezbollah in Lebanon, and for that matter, Hezbollah Da'wah in Iraq, in the days when it counted for something. In other words, during the struggle against the regime of Saddam Hussein. I talked already in the context of Iran about various structural problems internally. That is to say, the tension, not to say contrast, between an elected president and an elected legislature on the one hand, and a supreme leader who emerged from a process of, at best, indirect election. There's another aspect to the matter as well. If the Islamic Republic of Iran views itself not as a national state, but as potentially, at least, an Islamic political authority claiming the allegiance of Muslims elsewhere, then what should be the relation of at least Shi'i movements with respect to that already established government in Tehran? In other words, should they acknowledge its authority? Let us suppose that in either Iraq or Lebanon, a Shi'i-led Islamic government were to come to power. What would the relationship be between that government and the Islamic Republic in Tehran? In other words, would there be a subordination, shall we say, of the leadership in Lebanon and Iran to the leadership in Tehran? Would there be some kind of federal structure? How should this dilemma be solved? And to this, varying answers were given. Muhammad Baqir Asad, in his own writings on Islamic government, maintained that what he called the Islamic Revolution in Iraq should not eventuate simply in adhesion to Iran. In other words, that the independence of an Islamic Iraq should be maintained, although in its political structure it would considerably resemble that of Iran. The case of Lebanon is slightly different. Hezbollah originally called for the erection of an Islamic Republic in Lebanon also. Basing its claim or its ambition on the fact that the Shia constitute the largest religious community in the country, although not a majority. Also, they hope to attract considerable numbers of Sunnis to this cause, which would then put them over the 50% mark. But still, this proved to be, for various reasons, an excessively ambitious goal. Later, the goal was explicitly renounced. So that part of the, the establishment of an Islamic Republic in Lebanon is no longer part of the goals of Hezbollah as a political organization. They pledge themselves to respect the existing constitutional structure. However, as far as the relationship with Iran is concerned, the leadership of Hezbollah does indeed recognize, in a certain sense, the supreme leadership also of the Islamic Republic. So that there is a particular relationship of loyalty to the Rahbar, to Sayyid Ali Khamenei, the present leader of the Islamic Republic. So that in last Friday's demonstrations on Yom al-Quds, the day of Jerusalem, which I explained to you, the last Friday in Ramadan, an occasion set aside for commemoration of all that has happened in Palestine and in Jerusalem in particular, the Hezbollah parade in Beirut. You saw many pictures being carried of Khamenei, not significantly enough, not of Khatami. Khatami being viewed as a less significant and sympathetic figure from the point of view of Hezbollah and its organization. Finally, with respect to Hezbollah, some personalities that are worthy of mention. To begin with, Sayyid Muhammad Hussein Fadlallah. he was regarded as the initial source of inspiration for Hezbollah. And it can be roughly said, approximately said, that his relationship to Hezbollah was like the relationship of Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr in Iraq to Hizb al-Da'wah. That is to say, a founding figure, excuse me, but not organizationally involved in the day-to-day affairs of the organization. Another source of inspiration. Sayyid Muhammad Hussein was himself of Lebanese origin, studied in Najaf in Iraq, returned to Beirut in 1966, where he was initially at least overshadowed by Musa Sadr, the founder of the Harakat al-Mahrumin and Amal, the two Lebanese organizations that I mentioned last time. Things began to change in the early 70s. A number of other Lebanese graduates of Najaf returning to Lebanon joined him. And then a turning point came with the revolution in Iran and the posting to Lebanon of the first Iranian ambassador after the revolution, Ali Akbar Mokhtarshahi. Yafar Mukhtashani had, in the course of the revolution, been influential in the formation of the Revolutionary Guards in Pashtaran that were particularly in the early days of the Islamic Republic important for its preservation. The army was in a state of transition, being purged of royalist elements, and it was therefore necessary to bring into being a separate militia, the Pashtaran, the guardians of the revolution. And with this experience, Mokhtashani came to Lebanon and joined up with Sayyid Muhammad Hussein Fadlallah, his circle of Lebanese followers, and helped in the organization, the initial organization of Hezbollah. However, it is a mistake to think that Fadlallah has been and is today a leader of Hezbollah as such. He took his distance from Hezbollah, not because of disagreement with its policies, but rather in order to establish his position as a marja. Roughly the same can be said with Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr. After all, if a religious scholar ties himself to an organization, this might be seen as limiting his appeal to the community at large. And therefore, Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr, although he was a founding figure of Hizb al-Da'wah, removed himself from its running in order to function as a marja, as a source of authority for the broader Shi'i community. And Fadlallah did the same. He distanced himself from Hezbollah. And he is today a relatively important marja. I don't know how one would quantify matters, but he does have a serious following, not only among Lebanese Shia, but also Shia elsewhere in the world. He has been controversial within the Shia community for a number of his views. For example, he has called into question the historical authenticity of some of the narratives that have been much beloved of Shi'i tradition. Those of you that took the first half of this class last semester may recall the traditional belief that after the death of the Prophet, when Abu Bakr became the first caliph, Omar went the rounds of Medina in order to ensure that everyone would pay him allegiance, would accept Abu Bakr as the first caliph. Let me just write the names up in case. And it is said that when Omar came to the house of Ali and Fatima, And, of course, from the Sheen point of view, who ought to have been the first successor to the Prophet, and his wife Fatima, the daughter of the Prophet, when he came there, he slammed open the door and injured Fatima, who was immediately behind the door, causing her to miscarry. Now, this is a traditional account. Muhammad Hussein Fadlallah has raised some questions concerning it. For example, why would Fatima have gone to open the door when there were men folk in the house? And would Imam Ali have stood aside while he saw his own wife being insulted and placed in danger? And this questioning of a traditionally beloved narrative has made of him something of a controversial figure within the Shia community. Likewise, he has given fatwas concerning the permissibility of music. The permissibility of music is in general questioned in fiqh, in jurisprudence, whether it be Sunni or Shi'i. Generally speaking, however, I think it's fair to say that the most restrictive of all of the schools of jurisprudence with respect to music is the Shi'i jurisprudence. Fadlallah, however, has taken for want of a better word, a liberal view on the matter and proclaimed large categories of music that are permissible that other Shi'i scholars would not. In other words, he is a person with his own outlook and point of view, which has earned him a controversial status, but also a degree of popularity among various Shi'i communities. And he continues to exercise influence in that respect. He's sometimes designated still as the leader of Hezbollah. That's not the case. The leader of Hezbollah is currently Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, about his operational responsibility. I've already spoken about the operational activities, military activities of Hezbollah. There was one detail which also might be... two details. Firstly, I did an injustice to Jerry Falwell. It was not he that established this broadcasting station in Israeli-occupied South Lebanon. It was the other guy, Pat Robertson. So I'm sorry, I got my evangelist mixed up. So this should be pointed out. Another is that while occupying South Lebanon, the Zionists kidnapped a large number of individuals who to this day remain in Israeli jails. In 1988, for example, there was kidnapped from the south a religious scholar associated with Hezbollah, Sheikh Abdul Karim Obeid. Abdul Karim Obeid, who to this day has not been charged with anything. But remains in an Israeli jail. I guess his only offense is to be in a place where the Israelis didn't want him to be, which is in itself an unforgivable sin. It's also worth mentioning that the tactic that is currently being used in Palestine, that is to say, the killing of civilians while attempting to assassinate a resistance leader. This also was already practiced in Lebanon. For example, one of the leading figures in Hezbollah, Abbas Mousavi, was killed while traveling in a car together with all members of his family, women and children, by an Israeli attack helicopter, or should we say an American attack helicopter. I guess it, these days it comes down to the same thing. So that here too we see a connection between, a very intimate and close connection between the case of Lebanon and the case of Palestine. Now, as I said at the outset, because I was sick over the weekend and I was not expecting a large attendance today, I did not prepare myself as I ought to for the important matter of Palestine. So although we will have, after Thanksgiving, only two sessions left, I would like to postpone the discussion of Palestine until I've got things more or less in order so that I can compress, hopefully, the important points into a single lecture on next Tuesday. And for the remainder of this session, let me invite from you questions that you may have, either with respect to the course as a whole, or with respect to the papers that hopefully you're already busy researching and writing. Yeah.
So you said you'd read them if they were rough drafts?
Yeah.
When do you want them
back? A draft?
Yeah.
Well, if you have a draft right now, I get it back to you Tuesday.
Okay.
Next week, yeah. If you do have one, yeah?
Yeah.
Okay, good.
Right,
yeah.
After class?
Yeah, after class, yeah. Yeah.
Is an almanar a reference to the Shiva
Dajas? No, no, you're right. It's the same word. But no, almanar simply means lighthouse in Arabic. So it's just a coincidence of title. Yeah. Yeah.
I had a couple questions left over from the Turkey lectures.
Mm-hmm.
The reading suggested that the Kemalist elite was from the Balkans.
Yeah.
And I was wondering if you thought that had any significance in terms of...
Well, I don't know if they're from the Balkans. I mean, Mustafa Kemal himself was born in Salonika, which is in present-day Greece. This is delicate territory, but anyhow, you've raised the question. It is suggested in Turkey that he belonged to the community known as the Dönmer. The Dönmer are an interesting group of people. Why is it suggested that he was from the Dönmer community? Because Salonika was an important center of the Dönmer community. The Dönmer are because they still live in Istanbul, who stand halfway between Islam and Judaism. Their origins go back to a certain Sabbatai Zvi. I can't remember his exact date. Anyhow, he was a 17th century claimant to being the Jewish Messiah. And he caused a great deal of tumult in Jewish communities, not only in the Ottoman state, but also as far west as Amsterdam, the Jewish community in Amsterdam, all the way from there to Iran. In other words, impassioned debates within the Jewish community whether or not Sabbatai Zvi counted as the Messiah. Now the Ottomans, as I think I had occasion to remark already, were not particularly interested in what people believed among their subjects unless they started causing trouble. And the activity of Sabbatai Zvi was seen as troublesome, particularly when the officially recognized rabbinate complained to the Sultan that this man is causing problems in the community. Whereupon he was brought before the Sultan and offered the alternative either of execution because of his having caused trouble or renunciation of his claim, his renunciation of claim to being the Messiah, which would then solve the controversy within the Jewish community. Instead, he imaginatively chose the third possibility, conversion to Islam. So he converted to Islam and thereby escaped the escaped execution, and also at the same time avoided the necessity of making a public renunciation of his claim to be the Messiah. However, there is a very thick book on the subject by Gershon Scholem, if anyone is interested in the subject. It's obvious that Sabbatai Zvi did not make a sincere conversion to Islam, nor did he renounce his claim to being the Messiah. And he retained a considerable following who came to be known as Dönme, that is to say, from the Turkish word dönmek. They had turned, i.e. they were converted. They'd gone through a process of conversion from Judaism to Islam. However, they remained separate, both from the mainstream Jewish community and from Muslims. And to this day, they have their own synagogues in Istanbul, or maybe synagogues, probably aren't too many of them, their own burial place. And generally speaking, they did not intermarry either with Jews or with Muslims, only within their own community. Now, what is the significance of this to Mustafa Kemal? If one seeks for, or if some people in Turkey seek for, an explanation for his profound hostility to Islam, then they hypothesize it might lie in his being of Dönme origin. The evidence is not really decisive, to put it mildly. In other words, indeed he was born in Salonika, but not all Turks or Turkish-speaking people with Muslim names in Salonika were Dönme. However, there is some ambiguity about the circumstances of his birth. He may or may not have been a Dönme, in other words. And I think, frankly, it's irrelevant one way or the other. The fact that the attempt is made, you know, to identify him as such, goes back to the tendency that is sometimes that we sometimes find that to explain away the attitudes, the policies followed by unpopular figures. I mean, sometimes it's said, for example, that the Saudi family is of Jewish origin. Well, no, I mean, you know, really, there's not a long history of Jewish settlement in Najd. Or Abdel Nasser, it was said, he grew up in a Jewish neighborhood. Well, no, I mean, this is, you know, pretty nonsensical stuff. But, you know, there is a sliver of possibility with respect to Mustafa Kemal. More significantly, to go back to your question about the Balkans, yes, Salonika, and for that matter the rest of Macedonia, which was still part of the Ottoman Empire, was indeed an area of, for want of a better word, free thinking. Masonic organizations there were particularly strong. So that the policies enacted under the Republic could in part be explained by that Balkan background, that's true.
Yeah. For a few minutes, you spoke a little bit about like the woman's impact in terms of the Iranian revolution. Mm-hmm. If we can expand on that on our papers, but is there anything that you wanted to comment about?
Well, yes, that's certainly a viable topic. Subjects that you might cover under that heading would include mass participation of women in the demonstrations that will form the core of the revolution. Then also the various changes in legislation that occurred after the revolution, touching on matters such as marriage and divorce. The repeal of the family law that had been passed by the Shah, bringing back, of course, the possibility of polygamy, but also you might include there other, maybe less easily anticipated changes. For example, a marriage contract provides traditionally for two types of dowry, as you will know. One immediate, in other words, which is to be paid to the bride on consummation of the marriage. It may be a large sum, it may be a small sum, it may be entirely nominal. It may not even have material value. And then another amount, which is supposedly held in reserve for the case of divorce. Now, if a divorce happens after a considerable number of years, then the purchasing power of that sum of money originally set aside will obviously have declined. So one change that has been made in the relevant legislation in Iran now, which ingeniously does some measure of economic justice while preserving while preserving the letter of the law, is the following. Again, under Islamic law, the wife is, this is a dangerous thing to say, they're probably aware of it already, women are not obliged to do the housework they're not obliged to do the housework, they're not obliged to make any material contribution to the household. This falls entirely on the shoulders of the husband. But of course, as a matter of practical reality, thank God, this is not a privilege that commonly is enacted. However, now we come to the question of a divorce. If a divorce does indeed take place, then the wife can, with the support of the court, say, how about all this work I've been doing all of these years for you, which I was not obliged to do under the terms of the marriage contract. I never got paid for it. Now it's time to pay up. And then the court can assess an amount of retrospective payment for the wife's housework, which will bridge the gap between these amounts specified in the contract and its original purchasing power. So there's that kind of device, which under that heading money you could include. And let's see what else. Then, of course, the mass increase in female literacy, large-scale presence of women in universities, beyond those fields that were traditional. In other words, in the Faculty of Letters in Tehran, you'd always see a large number of female students, but not many in medicine or engineering. Now that's changed. I think it's true to say that in all faculties of Tehran University, there is now a majority of female students. Also, we have, of course, a number of female representatives in the majlis. One vice president under Khatami, who is a woman, I can't remember her name. Mariam is her first name, I can't remember her second name. Then also there is the question of women being judges, which is very difficult to implement under the understanding of Islamic law, but now a kind of women assistants are assigned to judges for certain types of case, and it is plain that in some cases it's those assistants that render the verdicts rather than the judges to whom the responsibility is formally entrusted. So yeah, I mean, there's an interesting mix of measures and of consequences of the revolution.
You
can speak of different factions or different groups of women, as you can, of course, of men in Iranian society and politics. But if you mean that there were those women who began observing hijab during the revolution as a sign of political engagement rather than as of traditional religious observance, yes. By force of law they still all do, although in some cases it's minimal. The scarf recedes towards the back of the head more every month. There are some women who have written sort of revisionist texts also. I mean, the best known revisionist texts on theories of Islamic government have all been written by men. But there are one or two that have been written by women also. Not that I can recall the name right now, and in any event, they're all written in Persian and have been translated. One other subject under this heading is muta, temporary marriage. which has, well, stirs practice in Iran for a variety of different purposes. But I don't see any real change in the currency of Mutta as a result of the revolution. Depends how broad or how narrow the survey is, what you want to survey.
For example, if I was thinking about doing one Mujahideen in North Africa, but then I was also thinking about doing a time period of political Sufi, of people who were politically active but who were also Sufis in a given time period in North Africa, rather than focusing on one person. I wasn't sure if that would be something that would be true.
Not just a listing of persons, and maybe take two, compare them, either from the same period in different regions, or from different regions, or the same region in different periods, something like that. Yeah.
Another question about the suppression of the Sufi orders in Turkey. Did any Sufism move outside of Turkey?
Actually, yes. In the early years of the Republic, some of the Naqshbandi sheikhs of the Kurdish areas of the southeast, yes, they migrated to Syria. In fact, one of the most important sheikhs of the day, he migrated to Syria. The Bektashis were a very strange group. I can't go into the details of their strangeness now, but nonetheless, they count as a Sufi order. They moved to Albania. They had always had a significant presence in Albania. In fact, probably half the Muslim population of Albania today is Bektashi. Whether that has any influence on their lives or not, I don't know. The principal distinguishing feature of most Albanians today seems to be gangsterism and smuggling and humans and others. Albania was a traditional stronghold of the Bektashis. And as far as the European migration, it's true. Particularly Naqshbandis became fairly prominent in Germany, because there was a greater freedom, even in Germany, to organize than in Turkey. And then one of the sheikhs that I mentioned, Mehmet Zahid Efendi, he was politically among the most important. He was the sheikh of Erbakan. I could write his name out again. Mehmet Zahid. I can't remember the exact date, but anyhow, the late 1990s, he migrated to Australia, because there was a large Turkish migrant community in Australia also. But Australia did not bring him any safety. He died there in a road accident, together with his son, which, together with other developments, has virtually put an end to this branch of the order. So there has been some distribution abroad of the orders.
Do you recommend any online journals, libraries for research?
It depends really what you want to write on. One very useful journal is the Journal of the Institute of Muslim Minority Studies. They have a vast amount of material on different things. Otherwise, there is this thing called the Middle East Journal, which is put out by the Middle East Institute in Washington, D.C., the Middle East Journal. The editorial policies are perhaps questionable in view of the fact that the director of the Middle East Institute is almost always a retired Foreign Service or CIA officer, which tends to colour the contents of the magazine so much, somewhat. Otherwise, no, I really can't think of a journal that is universally useful. Yeah.
This question isn't going to go too much into politics. It has more to do with Hezbollah. But when Hamas shifted its work towards social and city planning, like schools and infrastructure, they did it because they thought that military conflict was counterproductive. Would you argue that that's why Hezbollah went towards city planning and like social infrastructure as well?
I'm not sure the premise of your question is true. That Hamas tried, whatever you wish to call it, armed resistance, and then viewed that as counterproductive, and therefore shifted to social, economic, educational work. I mean, in Lebanon, I think the two went hand in hand. It's simply that after the expulsion of the Zionists from the south, what remained as the more prominent aspect of their activity was the social and the economic. But you think that's true with Hamas?
And that's the argument that's put forward, because this is going to be the point of my paper, plus the research.
Oh. You're going to argue that the increasing emphasis on economic educational activity?
That's what I'm going to try to disprove, that Hamas shifted, and that it's all along been a social plan.
Yeah, okay then. Yeah. But why set up a straw man in the first place? I mean maybe this is widely claimed, I don't know. But I think that in the case of both movements, both Hezbollah and Hamas, the two have been together from the outset. Which is why right now, as part of the so-called peace process, and the roadmap leading to a cul-de-sac, that the demand is made for what they call the dismantling of the terrorist infrastructure. I don't know what that is. Let me not utter that word. But anyhow, what is the terrorist infrastructure? It is precisely the social, economic, educational services provided by Hamas. This is what they want to destroy. In other words, to wipe out the organization as such, not simply to lurk to limit or certain activities. Really, the two have been there together from the outset. Yeah. It would seem to me. Yeah. Well, yeah.
Do you know
when final is? No, I don't. I would have thought that would have been a greater concern to you than to me. It's on the 12th. Friday the 12th.
Yeah.
Hmm? We have two different versions here. The 12th, okay. Friday the 12th.
Yeah. 8
in the morning?
5.
Well, that's almost as bad. Okay.
And it's the last day.
I'm sorry?
That's the last day.
Yeah. If you can get them to me earlier, then so much the better. Yeah?
I'm sorry, what can you tell us about Zayed Abu Amir, the guy who wrote about the...
Ziyad Abu Amr.
My pronunciation.
Yeah.
The guy who wrote about the Hamas and...
Yeah. Not a great deal. I'll try and find out by next Tuesday, when I give you my compressed lecture on Palestine. Yeah.
The readings seemed really quite impressive.
Yeah.
And I was wondering if you thought so as well, or if you just sort of included it. So.
No, I don't know that I would identify with that in any sense, but it seems to be pretty reasonable. Yeah, I mean, I would ideally, with respect to all of these movements, have liked to put before you documents in English of the movements themselves. But this, with respect to Hamas, has become impossible. You can't get to their website any longer. But anyhow, soon Al Jazeera will be on the air in English. So.
How so?
That will be balanced to CNN, Fox News.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, this might just be more difficult, but I want to write the alphabet reform.
The alphabet reform, yeah, I'll change, yeah.
Yeah, I know you mentioned that one, but.
Right. Yes, actually, it's a very interesting topic. The same thing was done in the Soviet Union for the Muslim languages. In fact, in two stages. First, from the Arabic alphabet into the Latin alphabet. But then, when the Turks did this, it was realized that this would facilitate, you know, the reading of books in modern Turkish by people in the Soviet Union, by Muslims in the Soviet Union. And therefore the isolation that the Bolsheviks aimed at will be undermined. And therefore a second stage was made, a second transition from Latin to Cyrillic. And then, you know, to make things still worse, a slightly different version of the Cyrillic alphabet was applied to each of the Turkic languages in Central Asia. I mean, on the old principle of divide and rule, for example, the Kazakh and Kyrgyz languages are very close to each other. But, you know, since the Soviets wanted to have a Kazakhstan and a Kyrgyzstan, therefore they made slight changes in the alphabet that was used in each of the separate republics. And this is proving now in post-Soviet days a very difficult process to reverse. I mean, the only country that has done it is Azerbaijan. Why? Because their Turkish is pretty close to the Turkish of Turkey, and the Turks have paid a considerable part of the cost in making the transition. So, you know, about the new school books and so forth are paid for with subventions from Turkey. But in the Central Asian republics, this has not yet taken place. They're still burdened with the Cyrillic alphabet. So yeah, I mean, the Soviet case really serves to bolster my point that, you know, the alphabet is really a marker of cultural or religious identity. Part of wiping out, or the attempted wiping out of Islamic identity, was the prohibition of the use of the Arabic alphabet. And interestingly enough, I mean, the only non-Cyrillic alphabets that were permitted to survive in the Soviet Union were those of Christian nationalities. For example, the Baltic peoples, the Latvians, Lithuanians, Estonians, they were allowed to still use the Latin alphabet for their languages. The Georgians got to keep the Georgian alphabet. The Armenians got to keep the Armenian alphabet. And also there was, of course, some use of Yiddish, and that was written in the Hebrew alphabet, but none of the Muslim peoples was permitted to retain the use of the Arabic alphabet. Yeah, then you can go to, you know, well, I don't know how far afield you want to go, but then, of course, under the auspices of colonial powers, the Latin alphabet was introduced either as a substitute for or parallel to the Arabic alphabet. For example, in East Africa, Swahili, which had always been written in the Arabic alphabet, began to be written in the Roman alphabet, Latin alphabet. And in Southeast Asia, the Dutch substituted the Latin alphabet for the Arabic in the case of the Indonesian language, and in Malaysia, the British did the same for Malay. And in Malay and Indonesian are basically the same language. Because of the peculiarities of Dutch and English orthography, the system used in the two countries was somewhat different. Until I can't remember when the Malaysians and the Indonesians got together and unified their orthography. So, yeah, there was that process there, too. But the whole subject is, at least I find very interesting. I mean, even Chinese, believe it or not, has been written in the Arabic script by Chinese Muslims. Yeah. I really have no idea how you convey, you know, the tonal system of Chinese in Arabic. But the attempt has been made. Well, if you have no further comments, questions, apologies for not having had my super compressed lecture on Palestine ready, but that will be our week today.
Even back.
Yeah.